First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me, and it's my pleasure to be here and being the second speaker in the Christoph session. The title could be maybe a bit misleading. We try to unify a framework, not the coarse-graining method. So, I mean, I realized that later after I submitted that. And most of the work of the framework is basically done in was done in Mainz when I was a postdoc in Kurt Krämer's group, and but it's still ongoing and at my time in Los Alamos. So just to remind you of things we have heard yesterday already, so coarse graining is like one essential part of the multi-scale business, because I mean you would like to have a model for a high resolution simulation and to maybe couple it to each other and to reduce the degrees of freedom, and you want to do that in a systematic way, and these reduction of degrees of freedom allow you to go to bigger time and length scales, and that's due to several reasons. I mean, first of all, if you map let's say a water molecule into a sphere, you have less particles, so you in the first place have to simulate less. Second, the effective interactions between these spheres will be usually very smooth, which allows you to go to bigger time steps. Then the smoother interaction usually lead to faster diffusion, which allows you to aggregate these kind of systems faster. And also the number of interactions you have to calculate also scales basically with something like the number of particles in a molecule squared. So there's even more to save when you throw away particles. And we want to design these coarse-grained models in a way that we link the reference or atomistic simulation to the coarse-grained representation. And when I talk about coarse-graining, I usually mean systematic coarse-graining, which means we are looking for a force field which reproduces a certain property of the underlying reference or atomistic system. And there are several groups in which you can group these methods, and I just want to mention there is a big group which are the structure-based methods, and we already have heard yesterday in the talk of Alexander Lebarzev about the inverse Monte Carlo method, and there and also about the iterative Boltzmann inversion. And there is a third method, which is the relative entropy method, and all of these basically try to reproduce the structure. And with structure, I mean bond distributions in a polymer or two-body correlations functions in a liquid, like the rate distribution function in water. Then there are methods which try to reproduce the forces acting on molecules, which is these force matching methods, or sometimes also called multi-scale coarse-graining method. And I mean, these also reproduce basically the multi-body PMF, and I don't want to go into detail with that because I think we will have a talk about this as well. And then there are methods which try to reproduce the free energy or the Servation free energy, and that would lead to something like the Martini force field. And from time to time, also there are methods which try to reproduce other properties like the pressure, and we have seen the pressure correction already yesterday in the talk of Alexander Lebarzev, and sometimes you want to reproduce the diffusion, which you can do by a thermostat. And the reason why I showed you exactly that list, because it's really incomplete, because there are, I mean, much more methods, is because we have implemented them in our framework, and we made it in a way that most of the methods basically take the same inputs. So we try to put them on equal standing, because it's very hard sometimes to decide which method works best for the system you have studied, and because there are a lot of different codes around, and you would basically have to spend a long time to convert the input from one to the other. We wanted to make it kind of equal for all of them, and we basically chopped up all the methods into like small blocks. And let's say for all the iterative methods, there's a lot of stuff which basically appears in all of them. And so by chopping this up, we basically allow for, I mean, very easy implementation of new methods, because you can reuse everything what we have already implemented for the other ones. And one design decision we made was to to use like existing sampling engines, which I mean existing MD codes. Yeah? And the reason for that is simply that we are too lazy to implement our own, and also we cannot really keep up with the development speed of GROMMIX and its speed. So that's the reason why we decided, okay, we build it around like an existing code, and at this point we have as a back end GROMMIX and LAMMPS, which covers like a broad set of features already. And the disadvantage, of course, of this decision is, I mean, we cannot do Monte Carlo because we didn't have any good Monte Carlo code at hand. So when we talk about inverse Monte Carlo, we are doing inverse Monte Carlo with an MD simulation as a sampling engine. So, but it doesn't matter in the end because it's canonical ensemble. So after making these decisions, we basically came up with the following parts. And the first part is basically like a mapping engine. It takes the high resolution simulation results and maps them on the coarse grained level. And then we can analyze these coarse grained level, calculating distributions and these things. And we have done that in a way that we can do this in parallel. And that is also important because at some point the coarse-grained simulations will become very cheap because the interactions are smooth and you have less particles and so on. And then the actual analysis will take longer than the simulation. So that is why it is important to also have like a parallel analysis. And the other thing we implement is like automated iterative coarse-graining. So when you have these things like Boltzmann inversion, we want to have it running automatically. And very recently, there was a part released of Vodka which is related to charge transport. Usually now the question is, what has charge transport to do with coarse graining? I mean, the answer is simple. So in charge transport, they have like big morphologies on an atomistic level, and then they map them into hopping sites for a kinetic Monte Carlo. And there you basically see the relation. They basically use this kind of mapping engine. Just to give you a number, we have about 40,000 lines of code. And at this time, 15 people have contributed to that. And we released the first version in 2009, which is also now in several Linux distributions. And there was another version in 2011. And I hope to publish something, another version soon. But now I basically want to talk about more some recent work which we have done with the Vodka package. And for that, I want to talk about these what we call the Kirkwood-Buff models. And the question we would like to answer here is, can we find a model which reproduces the Kirkwood-Buff integrals? And the Kirkwood-Buff integrals are basically like an integral over the radial distribution function and minus one weighted with the distance. And the motivation to do this is, of course, that these Kirkwood-Buff integrals are linked to these activation coefficients, which play an important role in the salting in and salting out of biomolecules. And the problem is that the definition is basically for a grand canonical ensemble, and only for very large system you can make the mapping to a canonical ensemble, and that makes of course the atomistic simulations very expensive and the systems very big, because you have to have something which is converged to one here. And that basically motivates us to design a coarse grained model. And how would one do that? So I mean, if one would be very naive, one would say, okay, I'm doing like a iterative Boltzmann inversion, which basically updates the radial distribution function, and at some point they will be equal. And if they are equal, then of course the Kirkwood-Buff integral will also be equal. But it turned out it doesn't work. I mean, we basically did that for very long simulations, and what we saw is the radial distribution function basically looks absolutely the same as the one for the atomistic case. This is now a urea water simulation, and this is the radial distribution function of urea and water. And still, if you calculate the Kirkwood-Buff integral up to a certain point, it still fluctuates a lot, and it is basically far away from the one which we had in the atomistic level. on the atomistic level, and you would like to have like a plateau value here, of course. And so what did we do then? We were taking this basically as an input for another correction on top, and the simplest correction you can always come up with, same as the pressure correction, is basically like a ramp correction here. And we multiply this ramp with like the difference of the Kirkwood-Buff integrals, which is basically like the average of the end here. So, and then because with that would basically sometimes overcompensate a bit, we add another scaling factor here. And now the hard thing is basically to determine the scaling factors, and you have to do a little bit of fiddling. And we had a PhD student in Nico van der Veet's group, which in Darmstadt, which was brave enough to do that. And if one does that, then one reaches at a model which is much closer to the atomistic case. And now we, after having parameterized that, we can look at the properties of this model. And first of all, the differences to the iterative Boltzmann model are very basically very small. I mean, there's a little bit more here, because this is actually the important part for the Kirkwood-Buff integrals. And if one has parameterized this as a certain concentration and goes to a different concentration, one sees, okay, the radial distribution function at the different concentrations for which they are not parameterized fit pretty well. And one cannot go to much higher concentration. At some point, one has basically to reparameterize and use that one and again. And so basically what we did here was urea system, we reparameterized at 3 points and used them in the surrounding of these points where we parameterized. And what we see is that our model follows really the atomistic behavior very, very nicely, and it's much better than the iterative Boltzmann model. So, and we can of course also look at the these are basically the three Kirkwood-Buff integrals one has in the system, and the yellow dots is the new model, and the red one is the older one. So one can also ask the question, I mean, does it work for other systems? And of course we cannot test all of them, so we basically only tested like another one, which was benzene and water. And there the differences are slightly bigger, and the potentials are not really as transferable as in the other case. And for this system, we parameterized them at 0.2 molar. And the reason for that was that there was already work by Nico and Christine around, where they did basically the same thing. This is like the blue symbols here, and they did it with like a potential of mean force ansatz. And but I think they only did it on the benzene-benzene interactions, and their model was already quite good. And actually, it's as good as ours, or theirs are even better. So, but it depends a bit on what you look, because it looks very good for the benzene, but let's say for the water, it doesn't look as good anymore. So, and at last, we basically looked at the comparison to the experimental case, and this is now again, sorry for that, for the urea system. So basically, because there was experimental data available, and our model follows like basically the atomistic curve from which it was parameterized, and for some reason it even follows the experimental curve better here, but we don't really have an explanation for that. So what did we learn from that study? So the first thing we learned is basically, I mean, with iterative Boltzmann, we couldn't do it. And I mean, we're not really sure why, but basically we think that there's like errors in these radial distribution functions which are uncontrolled, and if you somehow integrate them up, you always get the sum of the errors. And the potentials which we derived are transferable over different concentrations, and I mean, this method is very useful to for, for developing models to study later than sorting in and out, sorting out. But it seemed a bit that the correction which we made is a bit ad hoc. So I mean, the question is, can we do this in a slightly less artificial way, and could we basically incorporate it in some kind of inversion scheme? And that basically leads me to my next topic, which I call targeted coarse graining. And for that, I try to generalize this question a bit. So, I mean, can we find a coarse grained model which reproduces other properties, so to say, non-structural related properties? And for that, let's reformulate what we are doing. So we are using like n input parameters, so in the order of 4,000, which are the potential tables to generate m output parameters, which are the properties which we are measured in the which we measure in the MD simulation, and then we rank their quality. So, and the first thing when one looks at these kind of things and looks at the number of properties we are measured, which are in the order of like the radial distribution function and maybe the pressure or something like this, so it seems a bit 5,000 seems a bit much. So this problem is really overdetermined. So in most cases, you would expect that maybe 10 parameters would be enough. And the other thing one realizes immediately is that this is basically, I mean, equivalent to the standard optimizer problem in numerics. So I mean, you have a certain kind of input parameters. You evaluate the goodness of the outcome of, I mean, you take certain input parameters and put them in a function, and it gives you back a value, and then you optimize this function. So that is very interesting. And the third point is, I mean, you could also see this as a minimization, but for that you would need to know all these kind of input-output derivatives, and I guess they are not available in all cases, so that's why we basically look at the optimization for now. And to play with this optimization problem, we come back to our well-known water study. So in 2009, we basically compared like iterative Boltzmann inversion, inverse Monte Carlo, and force matching for a SPCE water system at ambient conditions. So, and we basically mapped it in its center of mass. And as expected, the structure-based methods basically reproduce the radial distribution function, even if the potentials are slightly different. And then we also tried it with force matching, and force matching gets potential with a similar shape, even if it doesn't reproduce the radial distribution function, but force matching is also not made to do that. So what we see from the potentials basically is there are two minimas. So we should look in a potential space which has two minimas for a water potential. And and the second thing is, of course, sorry, I forgot that to say. So the second thing, this potential is relatively long. So we're looking for something which has a relatively long tail. So and so what kind of potential we are trying out as in the first place was the so-called CKD potential, which is the potential which is used in Marcus Tezano's membrane model. So the D is for Marcus, the K is for Kurt Kramer, and the C is for Ira Cook. So for those of you who are not familiar with that potential, it's basically a weak Chandler-Anderson potential, and then as an attractive part, you have a cosine-shaped curve. So this thing has three parameters, so two for that, one for the cosine, and then because we want to add the second minima, we add a Gaussian on that. So in total, we have six parameters, and basically the first one who did that together with us was basically together with me was Mara, and she did that for a different reason, but this also works very well for the bulk system, as you will see. And then we optimize the parameters with the Needler-Mead method, which is also called simplex from time to time, and we are also not the first one. We did that in 2007 in the group of Mike Klein. Some similar work was done. So, and when we do that, we basically end up with a potential like this, and as you can see here, this potential really nearly reproduces perfectly this gray curve, and that tells us, okay, I mean, six parameters are obviously enough to parameterize a potential like this. And the other thing which we see is that the potential is actually relatively short range. So we really, it really stops at 6 angstrom. So of course, with this scheme, we can now ask all sorts of questions. And of course, the first question which comes in mind is like, what can we do about the pressure? So because we can easily incorporate the measurement of the pressure in this optimization scheme, and the only thing we have to modify is the objective function, so the penalty function. We have to say if there is an error in the radial distribution function and an error in the pressure, how these two relate. And if one does that, then one basically ends up with a potential looking like this. And this is also similar to studies we have done before, where we have cross-grained all kind of water models and also did pressure correction. And always the pressure corrected models came out with lower minimas, which is due to the fact that in normal cross-graining, I mean, the pressure will be something like 9,000 bars or something, and you need to subtract something from the potential to take away this pressure. So far, there is not much which basically is an enhancement over iterative Boltzmann inversion, or like inverse Monte Carlo. I guess one could even do like this functional form with the new version of inverse Monte Carlo, which was shown yesterday by Professor Lubartsev. So, but of course we can now also ask the question, what's about the mapping? So, because we can shift the mapping point of the water around and see if we find a model which matches the radial distribution function better then. And this is just something which came into my mind last week. So the mapping is basically defined as some kind of sum of all the atomistic coordinates, and all these weights are in sum one. So in the case of water, when one wants to have like in symmetric mapping, there's one extra parameter, because the hydrogens will always get the same weight, because you want to have it on the symmetry axis. So, and there's no modification needed for the penalty function, because you just measure the difference in the radial distribution functions. The only thing which is a little bit new is that, I mean, the reference radial distribution function, of course, will change, because if you change the mapping point, also the reference changes. And we did that, and the results are just from yesterday. So if you change the radial distribution function, it comes out to something which is a little bit more spiked, but the yellow curve fits it better. And the reason for that is basically that it's always slightly closer to the black curve than the red one to the gray curve. And I couldn't believe it myself when I looked at it, but I later looked at the numbers, and it's obvious from the numbers. But what the optimizer did for the mapping was basically nothing else than it shifted it a bit more to the oxygen. So I mean, it's not exactly in the center of mass anymore, but now it's slightly closer to the oxygen. Of course, this leads then to other problems, because these cross-graining methods, where the mapping is not in the center of mass, you have to be aware that there are certain things which change for the dynamics. So with this, I'm actually already at my conclusion. So what did we learn from this optimization thing? And first of all, we realized, okay, 6 parameters are enough to parameterize a potential like this. And we also tried like simple Lennard-Jones, which only has 2 parameters, but that doesn't work out. And the potential is really short ranged, like 6 angstrom. We can, in the scheme, we can easily incorporate other target properties. And the problem with that is, of course, at some point, when you have a lot of parameters, I mean, simplex can get trapped. And it will also get very inefficient for more than 10 parameters. But as I said, I mean, in numerics, there are smarter optimizers than simplex. So we have also played a bit with the covariance matrix evolution strategy and the genetic algorithm. And this gives you even like another speed up, because these two, they kind of propose parameter sets in parallel, which you can, of course, then simulate in parallel. And if you do these kind of things, I mean, when you choose your functional potential wisely, then it can even speed up the simulation. And there's another effect to functional potentials, and that's, of course, it can easily be used like in all kind of packages. I mean, you see that from the Martini force field. It's so popular because, I mean, it has a functional form which is implemented everywhere. So, and the last thing is, of course, in the scheme we can optimize the mapping for water. That's maybe not really a good example, but let's say for bigger molecules like hexane or heptane or something, I think it would make a lot of sense to look at that. And I hope I could convince you in total that this kind of optimization view gives you like a framework to look for a broader class of coarse-grained models. And with Jess, I just want to make a little bit of advertisement for our package. So, I mean, we have a lot of people which contributed features to it. And another postdoc, Victor Rieder, which is now in Cambridge, and I, we basically act as the gatekeepers to save the quality of the contributions. And very recently, we got an implementation of the relative entropy method by Sikanda from Urbana-Champaign. So, and I guess this will also be like in the next version of the package, which I hope we will release soon. And there's just one more point. So everything which I've shown you, maybe except for these mapping simulations which I just done last week, is basically available as tutorials. So if you believe we did something wrong or just want to look up all the numerical details, go ahead, go to our website, you can find it. And with that, I just have to say, I mean, this work was in the beginning sponsored by the Max Planck Society, later by the SFB 625, and now basically by the Department of Energy. And with that, I thank you for your attention.
Christoph, you had these examples of urea water and water benzene mixtures, mm-hmm. and it looked like that for the urea water case, this improved method produced significantly better GFRs, for instance, also over a fairly large range of concentrations.
You mean here?
Yeah.
I mean, the iterative Boltzmann thing
is also doing pretty well.
It's also doing pretty well. I think we are just happy in this case.
So now when you go to the next case, it looks like that this new version for lower concentrations works better than iterative Boltzmann inversion, and then for the higher concentrations it's just the opposite. Do you have any physical explanation for that? This comes from? Or because if one doesn't have any explanation, one has to check it afterwards anyhow again.
Yeah, I think for the Kirkwood-Buff integrals, I mean it's more reasonable to basically look at these regions. So, and there our model basically does a bit better than the iterative Boltzmann method. But like you said, we have no. I mean we really try to explain that why there is this kind of behavior in this way with the concentration, and we couldn't come up with anything. So I mean, I must say we didn't know.
Can you go back to page 6? You showed the difference between the G of R and the capital G of R, if you like. The way, I mean, you agree that if little g is correct, then the capital G should be correct. And the fact that it's not just means your little g has a slight mistake in it.
Yeah.
And whatever slight mistake is evenly distributed everywhere along R is multiplied by R squared when you look at capital G. So wouldn't that just suggest, rather than fixing it by some ad hoc correction, that you just have to revise your convergence criterion for when the little g has arrived at the target?
Mm.
In some sense, weighting larger r's, like penalizing that more if it's off.
Yeah, I think we also tried that. So basically, I mean, usually as a convergence criteria, we just take the difference between the two and then square it and integrate it. And
Well, clearly, if you want to get the capital R, the difference between the two times R squared might be in a more appropriate converging criterion if you want the capital G to come out right.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's also like another approach which we tried, but it didn't really come to anything, which was basically like instead of doing this kind of correction, do it on the big G's.
Yeah.
So, and that's basically essentially the same thing, but for some reason we didn't finish that up. So.
Just a follow-up before I ask my question to that one. Of course, just taking the R square term doesn't help here in the update. You really have to integrate. I mean, it makes a difference, and updating on the integral is again not exactly trivial to calculate in the delta U correction. So I think that's the problem of using the Kirkwood-Buff integral to define an update, because that doesn't automatically gives you a rationale how to calculate a delta U. I mean, just including the 4 pi r squared doesn't help. I mean, that just falls out of this, out of. I mean, you really need to integrate. And then again, it's not clear how to make the update. Just to follow up on that.
I think Marcus was more saying about the convergence criteria. I mean, we choose a very dumb divergence criteria, which was in the end looking by eye if they are the same, but. But of course, if you have errors distributed along the whole interval, you should do some, you should blow up the errors for the big R's and use that as a number.
That's true. I have a question to following up on Kurt's question before. So to that slide 7, I think.
Yeah, you mean that here, yeah.
Was that actually done by applying a parametrization at 0.1 molar, 0.2 molar, and 0.5
No, this was.
It was all at 0.2 molar, I suppose,
all
and then transferred.
Parameterized
right?
at 2. Well, yeah, okay. It's the same model. I mean, here in this, in the other one, I showed you the reparameterization points because it's a broad range. We reparameterized. I mean, in the beginning, of course, we tried with something which we parameterized here, but it didn't work. And but for the benzene case, it basically works relatively well with parameterizing it at one concentration.
Could you go back to the slide where you introduced the Kirkwood-Buff models?
Yeah. You mean this one?
Yeah. The G that appears there is correctly identified as the grand canonical ensemble G, and that represents the you're not doing simulations in the grand canonical ensemble.
You're doing it in big NVT simulations.
Right,
yeah.
And it's equal to the GNVT only in the limit of infinite n, and for any finite n, there are going to be long tail corrections to the G, such that in principle you. If you're doing calculations in the NVT ensemble for one system size, in principle, I think there's no way of getting the GIJ out. In principle, because the only way you can get the thermodynamic limiting behavior of the paracorrelation function in the canonical ensemble is to do canonical ensemble simulations of different sizes and then extrapolate. So the thing that you want really represents an extrapolation to infinite size of what you get from a canonical ensemble, but you hope to match the numbers, you hope to invent a coarse grain system that gets those numbers out of a single size simulation that's coarse grained. And it strikes me that this might be essentially impossible. And so that may be part of the reason why you're having trouble doing it. There are going to be some questions that coarse grain models can be designed to do well. But to ask for it to solve the problem of going to the thermodynamic limit, which we often can't do at all by huge I think you're asking too much of a coarse grained method to reproduce parameters like that, that you would have trouble calculating even if you could do infinite amounts of simulation on the finite size system.
Okay, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there is this, but in the end, I mean, basically we compare it to the atomistic thing, which is also like not extrapolated to the, I mean, it's also for a certain size. It's also not finite size corrected, right? So, I mean,
Yeah, so you could try to match the G out to a certain distance, or to a larger distance or a shorter distance, but then you need to be precise as to what you're trying to match. And if you're precise as to what you're trying to match, then everything is much more straightforward, but you'll be matching it only for that size of system, and that will not give you the Kirkwood buff parameters that you really want.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think essentially we have done that by basically doing that, which is like an average over like a certain region here. We did it for a certain R. So that's what I'm.
But you're still not getting the
yeah,
the right,
we're still okay, not getting yeah. what is the real Kirkwood buff integral for the. For that, you would have to do like simulations of several sizes and take into account to find it. Okay, I got that point. Yeah.
I have a comment to that discussion. Of course, you're absolutely right, but in principle, you do not get the Kirkwood buff integral properly out of a canonical simulation. But when you make your system large enough, and it, for these kind of systems, they don't have to be that extremely large. The differences between a grand canonical simulation and another grand canonical simulation within the error bars are indistinguishable, even though in principle you don't get it.
Excuse me, very nice question about the coarse-grained particle-based modeling.
Yeah.
So that it works perfectly for the static properties, but not necessarily for the dynamical properties. So that, do you have any, I don't know, any hope or any ideas to extend these approaches to dynamical properties?
Mm.
What?
I think it's really hard. I mean, I think this is a well-known problem, and I mean, in for polymer melts, I mean, there are some theories which have been very successful, but I mean, in general, I think you cannot really say how to even understand what the dynamics of the coarse grain system is. I mean, usually it's faster, but for water, I mean, we have measured it, and it comes out that the diffusion constant is a factor four faster. But it's really, we don't really understand why it's four and not 10. So I mean, I really cannot say. So this is a very general question. So I think, I cannot answer.
Okay. So for you, as I want to try to use these kind of approaches, only
I mean,
to
these ones aren't. I mean, most of them are not designed to taking dynamics into account. Of course,
yes,
you can.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean, yeah. Of course, you can somehow. If you have a certain coarse grain dynamics, you can try to slow it down or speed it up so that it matches the atomistic dynamics. But I mean, most of the time, that's actually not what one wants. Yeah, because when one would slow down the coarse grain system, one loses one of the good advantages of coarse graining. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really about the question you're asking.
Okay, thank you.
How sensitive is that factor of four to the details of the fits that you told us about?
I think that's pretty insensitive. I mean, that's like an older study with Han Wang, and I mean, we tried a lot of different coarse grainings and measured the error bars and all these things, and it always came out to be, you know, 3.9 to 4.1. So I think that's the error bar of this thing. And
are there any other questions? If not, we can head off and have some coffee and reconvene in half an hour at 11 o'clock.